Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A few numbers to start things off on Veterans Day. The unemployment rate in this country is 5.8%. But for veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's 7.2%. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From APM in Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, November 11th, Veterans Day, and it's great to have you with us. The Labor Department released new jobs numbers last week, its summary of the employment situation in this country. The top line numbers were good, 5.8% unemployment overall. But when you zero in on veterans, on recent veterans in particular, the numbers are pretty different. For veterans who served in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the unemployment rate is 7.2%, as I said at the top. That might seem high until you look at what it was last year, 10%. Part of the change is that over the last year, some big companies, including Walmart, Uber, and Starbucks, have made a more concerted effort to recruit vets. Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates has been a strong advocate for that. Secretary Gates, it's good to have you with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
How does this process work? When does someone who's, you know, deciding to leave the military start to look for a job? Is it while he or she is serving, or does it happen immediately afterward? Just what's it like to navigate that process?
Well, one of the things that's happened mainly, I would say, since I left, there's transition training that the troops have to go through. More and more employers are actually going on to bases to meet with military people who are facing transition out of the military. So there's a lot of things going on, both from within the military to help prepare these young people to go out into the civilian workforce. But I think a lot of employers are becoming much smarter and more aggressive to provide that kind of guidance themselves.
Who's pushing for these companies to hire veterans? Is it the government going to Uber, going to Walmart saying, look, there's this huge pool of people who are looking for work, who can do the work, you should take a look at them? Is it the government that's doing that? Is it nonprofits? How's that happening?
No, I think it's coming from within a lot of these companies. I know that the ideas at Starbucks came from a couple of people in the management chain who had been in the military and brought some of the ideas to Schultz as the CEO and said, here's what we think we ought to be doing. I think it's actually been self-generated often in these companies by young veterans who have been hired and then are telling their own management, you guys need to get more involved.
When you were at the Pentagon, there was a lot on your plate, obviously, but was this something that came up, something that you were wrestling with at the time?
Well, I confess it came pretty late. We were pretty, you know, we were obviously preoccupied from the end of 2006 to really well into 2010 with the war turning the two wars themselves around. And I think it was only really toward the end of my tenure that we began to pay appropriate attention to doing better in helping these young men and women transition out of the military.
Just a couple quick questions here before I let you go. President Obama has committed to sending up to 1,500 more personnel to Iraq over the coming months. And I just wondered, do you think that that move was inevitable? We see these numbers ticking up. Do you think they're going to keep climbing?
Well, I think that there's, I understand the president's desire not to refight the Iraq war. No, I don't think there are very many Americans who want to do that either. The challenge that I think he faces is to draw a distinction between having a substantial advisory presence there and sending in battalions and brigades who are going to be the primary combat forces. But it's hard for me to see how they retake ground from ISIS, for example, to retake the city of Mosul without some pretty close-in Western, including American assistance.
And just lastly, you know, while there's this ramp up, we're attacking ISIS, we're sending more personnel to the region, there are the politics here in Washington where I'm sitting, politics that you have not been shy about criticizing in the past. I mean, how hard is it to execute these missions when there's the threat of these automatic spending cuts that were postponed these last 2 years but are due to take effect here in 2016?
Well, I've said publicly there may be a more stupid way to cut the federal budget than through sequestration, but I can't imagine what it might be. This is absolute madness because it requires you to cut the most important things that we are doing at the same level or percentage that you're cutting the stupidest things that we do. This Congress and the president have as a very high priority, getting rid of sequestration. If they want to cut the budget, then do it through the regular budget process and set aside this crazy plan that even they didn't want to enact.
Robert Gates was Secretary of Defense from 2006 to 2011. He's featured in a new book, For Love of Country, What Our Veterans Can Teach Us About Citizenship, Heroism, and Sacrifice. Secretary Gates, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
And one more number on the unemployment picture for veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. 712,000 vets from those two conflicts are not in the labor force. They're not looking for work. On Wall Street, record highs yesterday, but pretty flat today. Details when we do the numbers. Pam runs Continental Resources, one of America's most successful oil companies. It's acquired vast tracts of land in Montana and North Dakota for fracking, and Ham has gotten the credit for that, along with a pretty handsome pay package. His net worth is estimated to be in the neighborhood of $16 billion. Well, Ham is getting divorced, and his lawyers have argued Ham's gotten to where he is because of luck. That's because under Oklahoma law, it's better to be lucky than skilled. Since the judge ruled that Ham earned his success, he now owes his ex-wife a lot of money. It's the largest divorce settlement in America, almost $1 billion. And as Marketplace's Nova Safo reports, the judge's decision reflects that what Ham's credited with doing is pretty much what CEOs are supposed to do.
Until the mid-80s, Continental Resources was a natural gas and oil company in Oklahoma. But then it bought up leases in North Dakota and surrounding areas. It's now one of the largest operators in the fracking business.
The record is pretty clear that Continental made a whole series of decisions that were timely and shrewd and courageous.
Joseph Bauer is professor emeritus at Harvard Business School. He taught management there for 51 years. He says when a company changes course, like Continental did, the CEO is the pilot. But still, how much steering does a chief executive do?
I've spent most of my academic career thinking about that very topic.
That's Timothy Quigley of the University of Georgia. Quigley's research shows CEOs account for up to a quarter of a company's success or failure. More important is the trajectory that they put a company on.
If we were to put my mom in charge of Walmart tomorrow, Walmart would probably still outperform Kmart for the foreseeable future. The point is the trajectory that the company is on matters.
So the impact of any one chief executive is pretty limited, he says. And that's in America, where CEOs are more powerful and have more discretion. That's according to Craig Crossland of Notre Dame.
So in high-discretion societies, we're more likely to see big hits and big misses.
Crossland says CEOs in the rest of the world are less empowered.
And the places we tend to see CEOs being given least discretion is in East Asia. So societies like Japan, like South Korea.
And at the end of the day, Crossland says, weak or strong CEOs, it seems to have little impact on the grandest of scales, on a country's competitiveness as a whole. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
Starting Saturday, the health insurance marketplaces will be open for business again. Those are the exchanges created by the Affordable Care Act. Number crunchers at the Congressional Budget Office and the Department of Health and Human Services have come up with estimates of how many Americans are in those exchanges that are very different. That's partly a matter of assumptions, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer explains.
The Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, thinks a total of 13 million people will be insured through the exchanges in 2015. Health and Human Services says no, it'll be in the 9 million range. One reason for the discrepancy, the CBO assumes lots of employers will shift more workers from company insurance plans to the exchanges next year. But in reality, they may not be in any rush, according to Larry Levitt, Senior Vice President at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
The technical problems in the first year of the Affordable Care Act may have given employers some pause about putting their workers in these marketplaces.
And it's going to be a lot harder to sign people up this year because there's only a 3-month enrollment period versus 6 months last year. But also people who were most interested in getting insured signed up last year. The people left are harder to reach. Some are healthy and don't think they need insurance, or they're immigrants worried about deportation. Linda Blumberg is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute's Health Policy Center.
Even if the individual is here legally, maybe they have family members that aren't, and that creates anxiety about interacting with government programs.
So if fewer people sign up for coverage next year, what does that do to the premiums? Does it jack them up? Maybe, says Sabrina Corlett, senior research fellow at the Georgetown University's Center on Health Insurance Reform. She says if you have more people on the exchanges, you get a better mix of healthy people. If you have too many people needing lots of care, premiums go up.
You're going to be left with people who have higher health needs. They're going to end up costing more money, and that's going to come out in the premiums.
Corlett says however you crunch the numbers, higher numbers are better. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Brand new F-150 rolled off the assembly line this morning in Dearborn, Michigan. The Ford pickup looks pretty similar to how it's always looked, but now the truck's body is made out of aluminum. Some models of the F-150 are 700 pounds lighter than their predecessor. Ford calls this process lightweighting. The translation of that is the trucks will be more fuel efficient. Ford boasts making these new aluminum trucks will create 850 new jobs. Marketplace's Scott Tong says those jobs have also been lightweighted.
New workers at Ford and GM and Chrysler start around $18 an hour. That's good compared to other sectors. But put that next to $30 an hour. That's what auto workers hired before 2007 make. There's a new, lower tier of pay, says University of Michigan economist Don Grimes.
The people who are bearing the brunt of the adjustment to a more competitive world are the new employers and don't get nearly as good of benefits.
And on the shop floor, the high and the low-paid workers often do the same job.
It would be interesting how the employees are getting along. I mean, the guy working right next to you may be making a third less than what you are.
For new hires, life comes with a lot of new ifs. Retire well if your investments grow. Raises come if the company profits. It's all in the new contract between the union and the big three. Kristen Gicek at the Center for Automotive Research says last year it worked out well.
The profit-sharing payouts at Ford, I think, were $8,800 last year. But, you know, if Ford makes no money this year, they don't get that.
This is the brave new world. U.S. automakers have to be lean. More factory work is done by technology and not people. And the United Auto Workers Union has lost leverage. Once the UAW set wages that Toyota and Honda in non-union states were compelled to match. No longer. The end came with the 2009 auto bankruptcies.
A provision of those bankruptcies was that the automakers would become cost competitive with the internationals in the United States. So that was a complete turn of the books that the internationals set the wage and benefit package for the auto industry.
I.e., the UAW is now wage takers. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up,
when the economy turned down and the housing crash happened in 2008, I took the money that I had and I bought myself a fourplex apartment building.
One listener shares his take on the economy, but first, let's do the numbers. Talk about splitting hairs. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 0.01%, 1 point. Now the Dow's record high is 1 point higher at 17,614. The S&P 500 picked up less than 0.1%, also 1 point. And also, there's a new record close at 2039. The NASDAQ was up 0.1%, 8 points, to close at 4660. Financial firms took the low road. J.P. Morgan Chase withdrew just under 1%. Morgan Stanley shaved off 0.25%. Ditto for Bank of America. Goldman Sachs was flat. We told you about Ford's new aluminum pickup truck. The car company's stock picked up 2.5% as the lighter weight trucks started coming off the assembly lines. European exchanges were up slightly across the board. The bond market was closed. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Wednesday. President Obama concludes his visit to China and heads down to Burma. The Senate Appropriations Committee holds a hearing on the Ebola outbreak. On this day in 1954, Ellis Island closes its doors after serving as a federal immigration station for more than 60 years. And happy birthday to actor Ryan Gosling, turning 34. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. Each year, hundreds of thousands of travelers drive through Arizona's scenic Oak Creek Canyon on their way to Sedona's famous Red Rocks. In May, a wildfire scorched 21,000 acres of that canyon, and residents say the fire could have been extinguished much sooner if they'd been able to get a cell phone signal. The lack of cell service is a problem in many parts of the country. KJZZ's Laurel Morales reports from Flagstaff.
On the afternoon of May 20th, travelers driving through Oak Creek Canyon noticed a plume of smoke. Since they couldn't get a cell signal, they kept driving the windy road until they reached the fire station, 10 minutes away.
But I was very, very worried. I just thought this fire was moving so fast.
Lodge owner Mary Garland watched the blaze devour hundreds of trees and come right up to her property line.
I really thought the lodge was going to be burned.
First responders actually kept the flames from reaching the lodge and all of the other homes and businesses in the canyon. Chris Kazian is the Sedona fire chief.
Minutes are crucial. Seconds are crucial. Quick access makes the difference in our business.
Cell phone service is the key to living in modern society.
Canyon resident John David Herman worries about all of the potential emergencies you could have in a 12-mile-long cell phone dead zone.
You drove here, you could have had a flat tire, you could have gone off the road, I mean, had a heart attack. A million things could have happened, and you'd still be there.
There are hundreds of places like Oak Creek Canyon. If you look at a map of a cell phone provider's service, there are large swaths of the country that have no cell signal. The solution seems simple, erect more cell towers. In places like Oak Creek Canyon, Verizon and AT&T say the rugged terrain is a challenge. Sprint says erecting towers in places with few people is just too expensive. It costs about $25,000 a tower, and that's not including the permits.
None of the carriers are going to do what we want them to do for the sake of 50 families in this community.
But the carriers might put in cell towers for the thousands of travelers who drive through the canyon every day, says Mike Keeling. He's a cell phone engineer turned lawyer.
That traffic is a determiner for the operators of the cellular companies as to where they put their towers.
Keeling says a long, unpopulated stretch of highway between Phoenix and Las Vegas, for example, has cell towers because it's so heavily traveled by their subscribers.
And now if there were lots of folks there, then the return on investment would be available for a Verizon or AT&T or Sprint.
The federal government is working on a $7 billion program called FirstNet, which would get all first responders on the same cellular frequency. And that would put cell towers in those dead zones. But that program is still in its design phase. So for now, Fire Chief Chris Kazian is making do with an old emergency siren.
There are just a siren that notifies you. There's no voice and there's no means to tell you what to do once that siren's activated. Everyone just run in panic.
People often come to Oak Creek Canyon to get away from technology like cell phones. But as John David Herman says, it sure would be nice to have the option of turning that cell phone on to dial 911. In Flagstaff, I'm Laurel Morales for Marketplace.
If you've watched 5 minutes of Deadliest Catch on the Discovery Channel, you know that fishing for king crab in the Bering Sea is dangerous. I mean, you probably don't even need to watch 5 minutes of the show to get that. It is called Deadliest Catch. But anyway, you may be surprised to hear commercial crab fishing has actually gotten much safer. In part four of our series, Dark Side of the Boom, Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce looks at what the oil and gas industry could learn from crabbers.
Skipper Rip Carlton has had plenty of close calls during his nearly 40 years as a crab fisherman. One of the more memorable was the time he watched a man almost drown.
He was on the side of the stack, probably 25 feet up, and the wave came up and took him right off, and I could not believe what I had just seen.
The crew managed to get the man back onto the boat, and then almost killed him again.
He was definitely hypothermic. First thing we did is take his clothes off, throw him in a hot shower, and give him a shot of whiskey. That's the exact opposite of what you should do.
But Carlton says in the 80s and 90s, safety wasn't so much an afterthought as an absent thought.
We had no safety training. We didn't have life raft drills. Some boats didn't even have survival suits that can help you stay alive if you go in the cold water.
And crabbers were dying at a rate of 770 per 100,000 full-time fishermen.
Which is astronomical.
That's Mary O'Connor, the deputy director of the Alaska Pacific Division of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH. By comparison, the worst oil and gas fatality rate in the nation right now, in North Dakota, is 10 times lower. O'Connor says it was clear something had to be done. So NIOSH tried what's called the public health approach. The first step, getting information. For commercial fishing, NIOSH asked the Coast Guard to share detailed reports about vessel accidents.
They found that at least 8 of the 12 vessels that were lost were en route from crab grounds were loaded.
Overloaded, to be precise, with too many crab pots. In big storms, freezing spray weighed down the vessels, causing them to capsize and sink. So then came step 2, intervention. NIOSH shared the information with the Coast Guard, which started mandating dockside safety inspections.
If they were compliant, that was all good and well. If they weren't compliant, then they weren't allowed to leave the dock.
The results were dramatic. While 73 Bering Sea crab fishermen died in the decade prior to the safety checks, 12 have died since then. But can the public health approach, information followed by intervention, be successfully applied to oil and gas? Kyla Retzer is the head of NIOSH's oil and gas safety program. She points out there's no Coast Guard gathering oil and gas fatality information.
Sometimes there's very, very little information about the event.
And Retzer says not only is data limited, so is access.
It is a little bit more challenging to get onto oil field work sites. Anyone could walk onto a harbor and talk to commercial fishermen.
Still, Retzer and her colleagues are working on developing an approach for oil and gas that follows the Alaska model. And she's hopeful that it will work.
People in this industry work really hard in dangerous environments with heavy equipment, and they deserve the right to have every step taken to keep them safe.
I'm Stephanie Joyce for Marketplace.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focusing on America's energy issues. Ton of economic indicators out there that tell analysts how the economy is doing. There's consumer confidence, GDP, trade numbers. We mentioned unemployment at the top of the show. But the most important economic indicator out there is yours, how your economy is doing. We've been asking you about that for the past couple of weeks. Here's James Grant from Saratoga, California.
Well, I work in high tech in the Bay Area, and the economy has been good here, especially in high tech. When the economy turned down and the housing crash happened in 2008, I took the money that I had and I bought myself a fourplex apartment building. Since then, in the past 5 years, the value of that property has gone up, and also especially the rents have been going up. I feel like I've won on both sides. I know that the people renting, it's tougher for them. Because in the Bay Area, it's hard to find an apartment under $2,000. What you see is families of five squeezing into two-bedroom rather than getting a three-bedroom place, things like that. Even though the real estate prices are higher here, I think people especially who are in high tech can find it affordable. But it's very expensive living here if you're not in high tech because the salaries don't keep up and the costs are high. I wonder if I will be able to afford to retire in the Bay Area. I know my wife wants to stay, so we'll probably try, but it's hard to say. Still a ways away.
We want to hear your story. Tell us how your economy is doing. You can do that on our website. It's marketplace.org. This final note, one last mention of Ham versus Ham and that divorce settlement we talked about earlier. By the end of this year, Harold Ham has to pay his ex-wife a lump sum of $323 million. Then she'll get $7 million a month for a while. She'll also get the couple's home in Nichols Hills, Oklahoma, their California ranch. He gets to keep what's in his 401k and a $10 million jet. According to Bloomberg, Harold Ham had asked the judge for some family pictures, a few books, guns, shotguns, and his hand tools. He also wanted a geode in a quartz display. But in the end, his ex-wife gets to keep the rock. And that's Marketplace. Today, the Dow was up 1/100%, 1 point. The NASDAQ was up 1/10%, 8 points. And the S&P 500 picked up less than 0.1%, also 1 point. Our special projects team is Nancy Fargali and Millie Jefferson. Lindsay Thomas and Caitlin Esch are on the Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producers are Ariana Tobin, Shay Huffman, and Tony Wagner. I'm David Gura. Kai Rizdahl will be back tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.